that's here. What we are doing in this early section is when things got interrupted with the pandemic, we were in a series on the Survey of the Minor Prophets, and Alan and I have just adjusted that to take it through the end of May, this Sunday and the next two Sundays. We don't even have a theme for June yet, because we never even got to work on April, May, and June, but we are open to any suggestions you might have for that. So that is basically where we're at on this. Appreciate you coming out and being with us at this early hour. I'm excited about this and that we're able to be together. I told, I think, Brother Jim on the phone the other day that I was concerned whether we'd had anybody show up, because I've been listening to some really good preachers on the internet, and I was afraid people would just stay home and listen to Shane Scott or somebody else, you know. But I think everybody wants to be out and see each other and be with each other as much as possible. So today our subject is this survey of the book of Haggai. Haggai is the second shortest of the minor prophets. Only the book of Obadiah, which only has one chapter, is shorter. And it's a very simple and meaningful book. It was written for one purpose only. I'll say more about that in just a minute. But it was written to encourage the captives who had come back in the first wave of captives released from the Babylonian captivity by Cyrus, the king of Persia. They had returned from Babylon and settled in and were given the charge to rebuild the temple. But they had started it, and then they had run into some opposition, and they had stopped. And so Haggai's mission as a prophet was to get them back on track, doing what they needed to do. So as we look at this, the normal introductory matters. The prophet's name is Haggai. He's the author of the book. His name in Hebrew means festival. And so it's an interesting thing when you look at the book, because some of it is very sharp rebuke and criticism, and yet the overall meaning of his name and of his mission was to create a celebratory situation for the people of Israel. We know, because of the dating of the book, which I'll talk about in just a moment, that Haggai had to be in the first group of those who returned from the Babylonian captivity. However, not all of the names are given in the book of Ezra who returned, but there's no other explanation for Haggai's presence in Jerusalem at this time other than that he had to be in that first group. His name is mentioned 9 times in this short book, and so there can be very little question that he is identified with the book. But nothing else is told us about his personal life. What we do know is we know that he was accepted by the people as a prophet from God. In the book of Ezra, in chapter 5 and verse 1, Ezra says, "When the prophets Haggai the prophet and Zechariah the son of Iddo prophesied to the Jews who were in Judah and Jerusalem in the name of the God of Israel who was over them." So Ezra says Haggai is a prophet. And again in Ezra 6 and verse 14, the elders of the Jews were successful in building through the prophesying of Haggai the prophet, Zechariah the son of Iddo, and they finished the building according to the command of the God of Israel and the decree of Cyrus, Darius, and Artaxerxes, the kings of Persia. And so as we look at this, Haggai had this one purpose, and Ezra records in his book that he accomplished that purpose. Now, the date of writing is very specific. In a lot of the books of the Bible, when you start with dates, you talk about ranges. But that's not true with Haggai. In Haggai 1 and verse 1, it says, "In the second year of Darius the Mede, on the first day of the sixth month, the word of the Lord came by the prophet Haggai to Zerubbabel, the son of Shealtiel, the governor of Judah, to Joshua, the son of Jehozadak, the high priest." And then it goes in to the passage that Alan read for us. Well, Darius the king is identified historically as Darius the first, also known as Hystaspes, who ruled in Persia from 522 to 486 BC. And Haggai is so specific as to the date on the second year, first date of the sixth month, that knowing the records of the kings of Persia, that is September 1st, 520 BC on our calendar. That's how specific the date of the writing of the book of Haggai, or at least the revelation of the prophecy to Haggai, is. Zechariah, by the way, dates the beginning of his prophetic work approximately 2 months after Haggai. And Ezra records that the temple was completed in 516 BC. So the combined work of Haggai and Zechariah resulted in the project that had lain dormant for 16 years being completed in 4 years once he got them working again. As we mentioned earlier, the book has a very simple theme. You need to get busy and complete the work on the temple which God sent you back here to build. In Haggai 1, verses 7 and 8, thus says the Lord of hosts, consider your ways, go up to the mountains, bring wood and rebuild the temple that I may be pleased with it and be glorified, says the Lord. So his message was, the temple needs to be rebuilt. So the structure of the book is very simple. In your English Bibles, the book of Haggai is divided into two chapters. And I think obviously that was done by somebody in the ancient past and probably done based upon the relative shortness of the book. It was divided into two chapters. But in reality, the book of Haggai itself divides into a series of four recorded, which I believe we would safely say are the summaries of the preaching that Haggai did to the children of Israel concerning these things. And then there's one prophetic verse added at the end after these four sermons. So the four sermons can be summarized this way, and this is not new with me. This is Homer Haley and his commentary on the Minor Prophets divides it this way, and I didn't see any reason to change it. It's very, very simple. The first sermon is in chapter 1, verses 2 to 11. He rebukes the people for their indifference, that they've allowed the work on the temple to be neglected for all of these years, and he exhorts them that they need to get to work rebuilding the temple. And so Haggai points out that things had not been going well for the returnees. Their crops have not been good. The conditions have not been good. They are not prospering. And he tells them that, of course, you're not prospering. God sent you back here to build his temple, and you haven't done it. And so the conditions that you're suffering are because you're looking out after your own interests and not building God's house. Therefore, God is withholding these blessings from you. And the message has its desired effect. Haggai 1, verses 12 through 15 records that they start rebuilding the temple on the 24th day of that month. So they responded pretty quickly to the preaching of Haggai. The second sermon, chapters 2, verses 1 through 9, is a message of comfort and encouragement. There is a famous passage in this section of verses where those who have, of the older Jews who had been children and had lived in Jerusalem and had seen Solomon's temple that was destroyed by Nebuchadnezzar, when they saw the foundation of this temple and saw the work starting on that temple, they wept. And there's commentators disagree. Some say they wept because they were so happy to see the temple being built. But others point out that there's much that Haggai says about the fact that this temple is not as glorious as the one that there'll be glory later on. And that essentially that those who had seen the first temple wept in disappointment because what was being rebuilt was not what they remembered. Now, there's that normal human thing that we all have experienced at some time when we go back to something in our childhood. I can still remember the first time I visited my granny who lived over here on Smith Street. None of that's there anymore. After going to college and came to the realization that that yard that I'd played in all my life wasn't near as big as I remembered it being. And, you know, we have that experience of our own memories. And so our issue here is whether or not how much smaller it was and whatever. But the people are discouraged. And so Haggai reassures them and exhorts them to be strong and do the work. Haggai 2 and verse 9, "The latter glory of this house will be greater than the former, says the Lord of hosts. And in this place I will give peace, declares the Lord of hosts." And so this temple that is being rebuilt, and we'll talk about this at the very end, he says there's going to be a greater glory than the glory of Solomon. And so this temple is essentially the temple in which Jesus did his ministry. We think that's what Haggai had in mind. Herod refurbished and enlarged it from this, but it's that temple, that site, was the one that would have been there in the days that Jesus was on the earth. The third sermon is that of promised blessings. He had told them, and he was rebuking them, the reason why things aren't going well for you is because you didn't put God first. And so he reminded them that it had been their uncleanness that had resulted in the problems that had beset them, and that now that they are faithfully back to work, God will bless them. In Haggai 2, verses 18 and 19, "Do consider from this day onward, from the 24th day of the ninth month, from the day when the temple of the Lord was founded, consider, is the seed still in the barn, even including the vine, the fig tree, the pomegranate, and the olive tree? It has not borne fruit, yet from this day on I will bless you." I have preached a sermon in the past about verse 19 because so often today people use that phrase, "is the seed in the barn," to talk about the need to do evangelism. But this isn't an evangelism passage. What Hosea is talking about is you've had the tools, you've had the money, you've had everything needed to get this done, and you haven't done anything with it. Now, you haven't been blessed, but if you get out and you do this work and you persist in this work, then God will bless you. And then the fourth message is the message of renewal in chapter 2, verses 20 through 23. Haggai renews the promise of salvation to the Jews. The message is directed to Zerubbabel, who is the governor appointed by Cyrus when the people were to return from captivity. And his first promise is that ultimately God would overthrow the Gentiles who were ruling over them. And it took centuries for that to happen, but it was a promise that was given by God. And then his message of renewal and promise includes with a prophetic statement concerning Zerubbabel. It's the confirmation of the promise. It's connected to that point we made just a minute ago about the latter glory of the temple. But there in that second chapter in verse 23, Haggai says, "On that day, declares the Lord of hosts, I will take you, Zerubbabel, the son of Shealtiel, my servant, declares the Lord, and I will make you a signet ring, like a signet ring, for I have chosen you, declares the Lord of hosts." So this promise of the latter glory of the temple was ultimately going to be realized, we know, in the coming of the Messiah and his ministry in the temple. But he says to Zerubbabel, I'm going to make you a signet ring. God has chosen you. So that might lead to the real obvious question, well, who was Zerubbabel. In 1 Chronicles chapter 3, verses 17 through 19, we find out that Zerubbabel was the grandson of Jeconiah, King Jeconiah, who was taken by Nebuchadnezzar into captivity into Babylon. And so, even though he was the grandson of the king, he was raised as a captive in Babylon. But you know the story from the book of Daniel that Nebuchadnezzar took the brightest and the brightest of the young people, the nobles' kids and so forth, and trained them and educated them and put them in service to his empire. So Zerubbabel would have been in that group. And he is appointed by Cyrus to be governor over the people of Judah when he sends them back and specifically gives them both the charge and the money to rebuild the temple. But a signet ring, something of a sign. Sometimes families have a crest or something that is important to them. They pass it down from generation to generation. And that's how we would understand a signet ring. And I think we understand this going back to 2 Samuel chapter 7, beginning in verse 11. Even from the day that I commanded judges to be over my people Israel, and I will give you rest from all your enemies, the Lord also declares to you that the Lord will make a house for you. And when the days are complete and you lie down with your fathers, I will raise up your descendants after you who will come forth from you, and I will establish his kingdom, and he shall build a house for my name, and I will establish the throne of his kingdom forever. And I will be a father to him, and he will be a son to me. When he commits iniquity, I will correct him with the rod of men and the strokes of the son of men. So the promise to David that there would be the king forever coming from the line of David. And so when you come to the New Testament, in Matthew and the genealogy of Jesus, Zerubbabel is found in Matthew 1, chapter 12 and 13. Interestingly enough, and that's Matthew's genealogy is the Jewish male genealogy, which is assumes Joseph as his earthly father. But Luke gives the genealogy through Mary. And in Luke 2 and verse 27, Zerubbabel is listed as an ancestor of Mary. So Zerubbabel is in the line of Jesus on both sides of his earthly parents, and of course Jesus is the Son of God. So Haggai's promise is that through Zerubbabel, the Davidic line to the Messiah would be confirmed, and the restoration of Israel would be complete. And so it's through the work of Haggai that God encourages the people to return to their neglected work. So at this time, let's have a word of prayer. Cliff, since you're up here, would you mind leading the prayer for us? There was a question, are we going to have classes for the kids that are here? Is that all? Okay, we'll have our classes. So Cliff?